Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends and allies and students scattered across time and space, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is once again your nav, John Lash, recording in the early hours of the morning, Monday, November 26th, 2012. This would be nav briefing number 35. And the title is The Engendering Gaze. I see from looking at the Navigator Briefings page on gaiaspora.org that this is my first recording posted in the month of November, and here we are almost at the end of the month. So there's been a lapse for a month, and I'm happy to say that I've been well occupied during that time. And as we are now in a stall, I'm taking advantage of this moment to tune into what the stall can offer. And one of the factors that's kept me from posting a briefing to you all until now has been simply the abundance and density and crystal clear clarity and cohesion of what I find becoming accessible in this stall. I'm experiencing this stall as completely different from the previous ones that we experienced during the time that the lunar apogee was stalling before the satanic mask of Cetus. Now, as you know, the lunar apogee is around 10 degrees of Gemini, the sign Gemini, which is 70 degrees on the 360-degree ecliptic scale. We use the ecliptic scale starting at the first degree of Aries as a way to locate things in the sky. The ecliptic scale is like a ruler that you lay alongside of a drawing, and then you indicate what part of the drawing lies at the 1-inch or 2-inch or 3-inch mark of the ruler. That's how it's used. So the lunar apogee, which is not observable, can nevertheless be located at 70 degrees of the ecliptic on the ruler. And that corresponds almost exactly to Aldebaran in the Eye of the Bull. Simultaneously, Jupiter, in its retrograde movement, is at 72. That is to say, just 2 degrees from the lunar apogee. And it so happens that on the 28th, in a couple of days, there's a full moon at 67, which is within a range of 5, 6, or 7 degrees of those 2 points. Now, this is an extremely intense packing of events on the 28th of November, followed on the 29th of November at 1 hour universal time by an occultation of Jupiter by the moon. And as we know, we use those occultations of Jupiter to test Channel 16. So there's a lot going on right now. And I would like to report to the best of my ability some of the many, many things that I've been looking at and processing, if you will, in the last month or so since I've spoken to you. Before I start, though, I'd like to get something off my mind that was bothering me a bit at the beginning of November. Nav Briefing 33, called Focusing the GNE, was posted on the 30th of October. And I do go back, you know, and listen to my nav briefings from time to time. I actually have to do so, otherwise I can't remember what I said. Also, it helps me to develop continuity, which is really an essential feature of This experiment, maintaining continuity, is not easy when you're dealing with material that is as vast in scope and rich and resonant as the material of Gayan and Planetary Tantra. So I just want to say that I happened to go back and listen to NAB Briefing 33, and actually I was appalled. I don't know how it came across with all of you, but I found it to be really tedious, and I was asking myself at some point, what the hell am I droning on about? It seemed to be almost gruesome as I listened to it. It was just in the style in which I delivered that particular briefing. So anyway, I almost feel like I need to apologize for the manner in which I spoke. My delivery is not always perfect, as you know. I had the impression that I was really belaboring the obvious in that talk and being a little too heavy-handed in my tone and in my language. So if it came across to you as well in that manner, then you're absolutely right about what you were hearing. Okay, that out of the way, what's next? Where do I start? It's really hard to say. First of all, let me say something, if I can, about the current Dakini shift. Now, the current Dakini shift began on November 14th, and thus we are now about 12 days into the shift, moving toward the full moon, which marks the midpoint of the shift. Now, in my observation of the shift, was suspenseful, because I was keenly interested to see if it would fall in the Scorpion and therefore signify that Kamala was on shift. And watching from my terrace and also from the terrace of Ambergain House, I detected, indeed, on the 15th of November, that the crescent moon stood at the head of the Scorpion. And so I called the shift for Kamala. But I wasn't certain. Because, in fact, if you were not able to observe that in your region, or if you lived in an area to the west of me here in Spain, you would only have been able to see the crescent moon at a later time, and it may well have appeared to have shifted into the snake tamer, or even on the succeeding day to have shifted into the archer, therefore designating that the shift goes to Kurukula. So it was ambiguous, and as you know, reading these shifts and learning the art of attunement to Dakini frequencies is subtle and fluid, and often these events are not predictable. You have to be present in real time, interacting vividly with your power of observation, the first attention, and your power of imagination and visualization, the second attention. You observe the sky at a certain moment, and you never can actually see where the crescent moon is because it is still too light. But you can imagine where it is based on your picturing of the zodiac. So this is the exercise we follow. You learn over time to get better and better at it. You learn to anticipate that startling, breathtaking, and often arresting sight of the sliver of the sunset crescent, the first moment that it breaks into your perception. And all of this is part of the delightful rituals of Planetary Tantra. I've said before that this is not a cut-and-dried process. It is possible that some of us observing the Dakini frequencies might experience a Kamala cycle, while others might experience a different cycle that would be designated to Satyamama with the crescent moon in the snake tamer, or Kurukula with the crescent moon in the archer. This particular event, this month, November 2012, was a remarkable one. An event of remarkable power and subtlety, and it has taught me a great deal. Now I'd like to clarify that some of you, it appears from your mail to Navigator, have found yourself in an attunement to Kurukula during this shift from the 14th of November. And I won't disregard that or deny that, or I won't tell you that is not so. I will say that I have had the most intense experiences and the first clearly definitive experiences of the Kamala Mahavidya since I entered Planetary Tantra 3 years ago. Four. And I'll tell you a little bit about those experiences in a moment. But right now, let me point this out. This may go some way to explaining why there would be a Kamala shift, and I do call it for Kamala, and yet it would have a strong overtone of Kurukula. Why would that be? Well, when I was out there on Thursday night, the 15th, and I caught the glimpse of the sunset crescent, I observed, as I often do, the analogy of the sunset crescent to a satellite dish. It actually resembles a satellite dish. And so when you picture the concave, it's the right-hand crescent. So hold up your right hand and make a crescent with your fingers. Now when you picture that concave form and compare it to a satellite dish, you see immediately that the dish has an aim. Depending on the tilt of the moon and its position relative to the background stars, it will be aimed. Now, although you often can't see the actual stars in the immediate background of the lunar crescent, you can sometimes see where the crescent slash satellite dish is aimed. The reason for that being that it can be aimed at a star that is outside the aura of the fading sunlight in the darker part of the sky. And so you can observe the sunset crescent aimed or orientated like a satellite dish to a particular point in the environing sky. And this is what I observed. And I noted with some interest and some curiosity that the lunar crescent signaling the beginning of the Kamala shift appeared to be aimed to a very bright star, which was not that far away, off to the right and upward from the tilted crescent. Here I'm looking west toward the western horizon, here in Andalusia. And I thought, wow, I wonder what that star is. Presumably it's a star in the constellation of the Archer, because I estimated the distance from the position of the crescent moon against the background stars. And I said, I know that distance. I'm familiar with the distances and the proportions of these starry constellations. So I could guess that that star, which is distinct, strong, it was strong, distinct. So then when I was at my computer sometime later, I did the little cheating move. And I pulled up Stellarium and took a look, because I wanted to know what that star was. And lo and behold, it wasn't a star at all. It was Mars. So the sunset crescent that signaled the Kamala shift also signaled a secondary factor. It was a two-part omen. This indicated to me that the frequencies of Kamala would be linked or complemented or backed up or supplemented in some way by frequencies from that part of the constellations where Mars stood. And where did Mars stand on November 15th, 2012? just barely visible for, say, 15 minutes in the evening sky at sunset. Where did Mars stand? Well, it stood in alignment to about 27 degrees of Sagittarius, that is to say, in exact alignment to the galactic center, and it stood among the stars that indicate the tip of the archer, the tip of the arrow that the archer is aiming toward the scorpion. So there is the Kurukula factor. Mars in the archer, very close to the tip of the arrow, very close to the sighting mechanism. So what I read from that was that Kamala would prevail with her instruction in this shift, but that she would bring in and coordinate a powerful aiming force of Mars, of the warrior power and the healing power of Mars, because Mars heals, and of the Kali power of Mars, because it's iron, that Kurukula would, as it were, offer her hand and her steady aiming force to the instructions of Kamala during this period. So I'm not surprised that some of you have taken it for a Kurukula shift, and you've done very well and followed it beautifully. And this is how you learn this process, which is absolutely extraordinary. Do you realize what we're doing now? We're actually coordinating our psychic instruments to the same attunements, to the same channels. This is like a group of animals or a herd of animals that all turn their heads toward the same signal coming from the environment around them. We're interacting with the cosmos through these Dakini frequencies. Now let me speak for a moment without getting into it too much, because I know that some of you in the Gaia Navigation Experiment don't follow the Dakini frequencies. I still have to do a talk on that and a talk on Astronomy 101. But let me just tell you about my experience of Kamala, if I may. Up until a couple of weeks ago, when I sighted this lunar crescent, I had never been able to really tune in Kamala. You know, I started to track and transceive and profile the Dakini frequencies in the early fall of 2008. I started receiving intense Dakini instruction in the spring of 2008 from April Arnwood. Clear, vivid, clairaudient Dakini instruction. But it was only in October of that year that I organized the so-called Tantric Zodiac, and I made the correlations. Actually, I didn't make any correlations at all. The correlations made themselves. The correlations of the Dakinis and Mahavidyas of the Shakti cluster to the constellations came in the terma of Gaia Awakening. I didn't work them out mentally. I didn't sit down and ponder them over and consider different choices. I just wrote them down without a single moment of hesitation. Because that's how it is when you unzip the zip file of a Dakini terma. And so there it was. Kamala fell in correlation with the scorpion. Well, you know, I was born in the scorpion. I speak to you from the heart of the scorpion, always. And there was a Mahavidya associated with the most intimate home territory of my own celestial endowment. And guess what? I could never really get where she was at. In the time since October 2008, I've experienced a couple of Kamala shifts, and I haven't been able to tune her in. I haven't been able to profile her. I haven't been able to get any intel on what she has to say, what is the style of her instruction, what is the thematic content of her instruction. Well, that has all changed. And it changed on November 16th as I was sitting at Amergain House having a conversation with Kundri. And about a half hour into this conversation, which was a lucid and lively conversation, I stopped and I said, we're in Kamala instruction in this conversation. The nature of the things that we were talking about, the way they were revealed and the way our thoughts and feelings and words designed themselves in that conversation signaled me that we were in Kamala instruction. And at that same moment, I realized, oh, I see. There's a unique feature to Kamala's instruction, and that is that she instructs to couples in the action and art of dialogue. So she does not instruct, she may instruct on a singular basis to one person, I wouldn't rule that out, but what I have discovered is that her primary and preferred method of instruction is to insert her instruction within a conversation between two people. I don't know if that could be woman and woman or man to man. I suppose it could, but in this case it was man to woman. So in that gendered conversation, the instruction of Kamala located itself. And for the first time, I was able to vividly discern her frequency profile, as it were, and also to feel empathically the quality of this Mahavidya, who is traditionally designated as a love goddess. And then I realized, because she is one of these desideristic witches of the Shakti cluster. Wow, I mean, it was beautiful. The quality of the tone and tenor of her presence was absolutely exquisite. And it saturated us and melted over us at that moment. And I can't repeat the conversation because it was as beautiful as Quicksilver glinting on a mirror. That is the nature of Dakini instruction. But it was a lush and beautiful instruction. It was soft and it was full of a sensuous certainty and a combination of tenderness and courage. And one of the things I realized, and Kundry and I realized together, about Kamala is that she's not just a love goddess who teaches about love. She doesn't just teach about love. She doesn't teach about love alone or on its own. She teaches about love in connection with death. She teaches the mysteries of love and death. This recalls the old High German term Liebestod, or love death, from the epic of Tristan and Isolde that was written by Gottfried of Strasbourg in the beginning of the 13th century, exactly at the same time that Wolfram von Eschenbach wrote Parzival, Liebestod, the love death. And if you want to know what the love death is, then listen to Wagner's musical composition of Tristan and Isolde. And there is a passage in that symphonic composition called the love death. And see if that puts a thrill into your booty. Now, I was chagrined, and I grinned, and I scratched myself, and laughed at myself, because, you know, Rilke said, you can never see what is closest to you, and what is most intimate and most obvious, or it's the last thing you see. Well, of course, one of the themes of the Scorpion constellation is the love death of Tristan and Isolde. And therefore the unity, the transcendent unity of death and love is Kamala's theme. But it goes much, much deeper. Her instruction also includes many beautiful insights into the transpersonal character of love, the way that it transcends life and death, the power of carnal faith, as I call it, in the essays on the alternative history of the Grail in metahistory.org. the power of carnal faith. For instance, the assertion, and this was part of the conversation I had with Jill, the assertion that your love for someone else ensures that you will see them in the after-death experience and that you will never lose them ever in this world until the return of all human doubles into immersion with their Andromedan counterparts. Gottfried of Strasbourg could not finish Tristan because he stated in Tristan that the passion of those lovers, Tristan and Isolde, was equivalent to a holy sacrament. It was just at that same time in the 12th century, around 1240, through the so-called Lateran Council, that the Catholic Church facetiously and invidiously introduced the doctrine of the transmutation, and that is to say the transmutation of the bread and wine into the flesh and blood of Christ, the Redeemer. Gottfried of Strasbourg, who lived during that time, was deeply aware of the nefarious deception contained in that horrible dogma, which is a false magic and a lie perpetrated on human beings. And so in Tristan and Isolde, you can read the beautiful lines where he says that their passion was their mass, it was their sacrament, and that the suffering of their passion, their separation from each other in life and in death, was like the blood and the wine of the Holy Mass, and even better. And for that, the Vatican sent out a band of inquisitors to hunt down Gottfried of Strasbourg, and that's why he did not finish Tristan and Isolde. The last chapters were unfinished, or if they were finished, they were lost. He went into hiding, and it is genuinely agreed by scholars that the book was finished by his friend Thomas of Britain, who happened to be at that moment out of reach of the inquisitorial SWAT team. So anyway, this whole story was part of the subject of our magnificent conversation on that Friday night. And from that moment on, during the ensuing days until now, I have been steeped and saturated in the most lovely glow of gratitude for the loving and exquisite quality of Kamala's instruction. And I have received things that have passed through me as if I was a sieve that I cannot now repeat, but in subliminal transception, I knew her teaching, and I continue to know her teaching. And I can tell you that there is so much, so very, very much to be learned from her. If you do not consider love on its own merits or on its own power, but if you consider the subjects of love and death, love and mortality in the same moment of contemplation, that is the secret, one of the secrets of her transmission. The other secret is, as I said, that she prefers, I would say, to release her transmission in the undulating waves that proceed between two people in deep conversation. And that's a unique mark of the method or technique of Kamala. Finally, I will just add this, that the scorpion is the constellation in which the venom of Kali's lethal strike is prepared. You know that, don't you? And the venom is being prepared. And the upcoming perigee hit in 17 degrees of Sagittarius is right in the center torso of the scorpion, below the heart. That is a moment of the preparation of this precious venom. And what I came to understand was that those of us who would care to consider the killing power of Kali and of Sophia herself, as it may be used in the service of life, as it may be applied to protect humanity and all our kindred animals and the natural world from predators and from the insanity of those psychopathic maniacs. All of that is an understanding and an instruction and a deep initiation in the mysteries of death that can only be held in your mind simultaneously with an understanding of the mysteries of love. It may come to be realized, it may come to be stated in the near future. That the sacred act of the lethal strike is an act of love. That does not mean necessarily that one feels love for the predators. No, I can guarantee you it ain't going to come out in that language. Love for the predators is absolutely useless. They are not affected by it. It does nothing for them. They don't even know it exists, and it's meaningless, and it's a waste of time. But in some respect, through the teaching of Kamala and through the deeper instructions of Kali herself in the coming months, I am convinced the moment has come to understand the mysteries of love and the mysteries of death as they are profoundly and inextricably connected. In the frame of that understanding, the formulation and application of the lethal strike can be seen in their true light. So I've taken half an hour here just talking about that, and I just wanted to share with you how much I love the feeling of this Mahavidya. And I have been, it is sweet, sweet, sweet to feel her wisdom. It's like a nectar, it's like a balm that goes into your veins. It's like honey in your veins, the instruction of Kamala. Honey in your veins. And the clear light of sanity in your mind. The clear light of sanity that accepts mortality and finds the teaching of death to be a teaching about the deathlessness of love. What dies is one thing. What does not die is something else. In the remaining half hour or so of this briefing, I would be really pleased if I could just accomplish two things. Just get two things across to you, because really there's so much going on. I have to select a tiny sliver from the vast array of realizations that are unfolding right now. First thing that I want to point to is the perigee hit that occurred on the first day of the Kamala instruction. Now, isn't it remarkable? Or wouldn't it be remarkable, would you think? Considering that Kamala instructs in the deathlessness of love, that on the first day of her shift, in this decisive moment in correction, perigee surge is in 29 Scorpio, which is 239 of the ecliptic scale, and that is to say, right in the claw of the scorpion, right at the point of impact, where the upper claw of the scorpion jars the pan of the scales. Wowee. What could be more eloquent than that? Now, I'd like to point out that the great shakeup that has been happening in the scales that we've been observing is now coming to a conclusion. And there is a moment of precise conclusion of that shakeup. If you look ahead at the perigee surges, you'll find that there is a repeat perigee surge in that same position. And that occurs on March 31st, 2013. So there's a hit in the claw of the scorpion on November 14th, 2012. And then again, finally, the last hit that involves the scales on March 31st, 2013. That, my friends, is the shake of things to come. By shake, I refer, of course, to the shaking of the crossbeam of the scales under the impact of the scorpion. I'm not going to elaborate right now on what is happening in the area of the scales, but I'll just remind you that I've pointed out that the events that in the world at large that can be seen to correlate closely in timing to the hits in the right and the left pans of the scales have described a series of catastrophic upheavals and scandals which are bringing down the whole world financial system. The exposure of the fraudulent and deliberately fraudulent and rigged nature of the system has occurred in close coordination with the succession of perigee hits in the scales. This is a remarkable thing to observe, and you in the GNE who have learning the art of these observations, I'm sure appreciate deeply what I'm saying here. I have to say, though, that my perception has changed since the beginning of observing those perigee hits in the scales, of which the upcoming one on March 31st would be the last that involves the scales. It's not really in the scales, but it's in the claw that whacks the scales. Okay? Picture that. I've had cause to reflect strongly since the time of the last hit on November 14th. Reflect, or I should say, recollect the time in my life during which I developed that imagery. Now, I'm not going to go into a long song and dance about this, but I'll just say that probably from the early 70s onward, as I was developing the real sky zodiac or stellar zodiac, I made countless drawings of those constellations, those 13 constellations that lie on the ecliptic, which is the apparent path of the sun and actually is the orbital plane of the earth. And I reintroduced Ophiuchus, the serpent charmer, into the zodiac. Should never have been omitted. The stars of Ophiuchus are, in certain respects, merged with the stars of the scorpion, snake tamer scorpion complex, if you will. And I also designed those constellations with a specific intention to show the scorpion reaching up with its claws and jarring the crossbeam of the scales. Now, you'll find countless illustrations of these constellations in ancient star lore, countless drawings, and you'll find a number of descriptions in long poems in the Greek language, such as the Phenomena of Aretas and other poems describing the constellations, which will indicate in language rather than in visual form, will indicate in language, will tell you in language what the scales look like and what the scorpion looks like. But as far as I know, I am the individual who designed those constellations so that scales and scorpion are interactive. And I remember very distinctly sitting in a croissant joint in Santa Fe near the Capitol one day with one of my students, Justin Olson, student of the course I was giving. Justin was a fantastically lively mind and always a great pleasure to discuss things with him. And I had just come from the copy store where I had made copies of my definitive drawing of the scorpion scales scenario. And I showed him what it looked like, and I showed him how I had examined the star positions in detail. And made the artistic choice, if you will, to show the scorpion reaching up and jarring the crossbeam of the scales. No one else has ever proposed that description. And so that was a big moment for me because it was a big event in my imaginative life. And it was also that design was the product of a great deal of work and contemplation and astronomical study. I didn't come by it superficially or slightly. I came by it through extremely intense consideration over a long period of time. I made the artistic decision to depict it in that way and to develop the storyline or narrative that would go with that depiction. And so I became at that moment, as most artists, as artists can happen with artists, I became attached, as it were, to my own creation, you know, and I thought, okay, the scorpion jars the crossbeam of the scales, the scorpion jars the crossbeam of the scales. What does this mean? And when I first tentatively introduced teachings about that imagery, that was back in Santa Fe during those years, the mid-80s, this is what I said. Well, it appears like the scorpion is a menacing, sinister figure that rises up out of the Milky Way, this crusty creature. We know it's dangerous, poisonous. You don't want to find it in your bed, as I did several times when I was living in Jalapa in Mexico with Jan Kerouac. You don't want to find that crusty creature in your bed. You don't want to get stung by a scorpion, because if it doesn't kill you, it's going to give you the most horrific hallucinations and pain through your veins that you could possibly ever bear. And so this creature, probably, I said at the time, probably represents some kind of cosmic force, a death-dealing, toxic force, if you will, that comes out of the depths of the Milky Way and jars the crossbeam of the scales, meaning what? Meaning that it upsets the balance of cosmic order. And this is what I was teaching, and this is what I was thinking, and this is the lesson that I carried on and contemplated over many, many years. That is a mathematic proposition put in the form of a story. You develop the story in your imagination, and you milk it for what you can get out of it. That is to say, psychological, spiritual, ethical insights, whatever. Well, I'm here to tell you that something momentous has happened in my imagination in the last month. And it came into focus almost immediately in the first days of the Kamala shift following this perigee hit in the claw of the scorpion. Suddenly it occurred to me, I'll give it to you like fast and simple, folks. Suddenly it occurred to me, didn't it, Nikki? Yeah, you were there. You observed that moment. Nikki observes a lot of my psychic processes and checks them out and reports back, as you know. She's a 28 coil Naga, really, but appears to be a small black cat, currently sitting beside my computer. Nikki, or my Nikita, can confirm to you that I underwent a sudden and total shift of perception about the scorpion. Like that, it flashed in my mind. What if the scorpion, the gesture of the scorpion reaching up to jar the crossbeams of the scales, is not an act of upsetting cosmic balance, but of resetting the balance? And that's it, you see. The scorpion jarring the scales is the image of reset. And the power in the scorpion, which includes a lethal element, is what allows the reset to work. Now, the power in the scorpion is also the power that is being formulated and cooked into Kali's venom for Sophia's lethal action against the perpetrators on this planet. The goddess herself is taking lethal action. If you would want to understand that, just look back at the ancient mythological precedents of the scorpion. What myths, what sidereal or stellar mythology is attached to the scorpion? Well, it's one of the oldest myths on this planet and refers back to the prehistory of prehistory of prehistory, way, way back into the earliest days of life on this planet. And it refers to the period of what I call the Thonian romance, that is to say, the romance between the Gaian women of the planet and the men from Orion. Now, these men from Orion, who descended on Aka cords from the Orion Nebula, M42, were hunters. And so the name Orion is not so much the name of a particular individual as it is the generic name for those hunters, the counterpart of the human strain that represented the complement and completion of the Gaian women, although neither side understood that proposition, and we still don't today. These Orion hunters, as the story goes, were thrilled and delighted to come into the earthly paradise of the Gaian women. They came upon a planet that's only inhabited by gorgeous women who had the form of trees, shape-shifting women. And can you imagine what that would be like if you were a man? That would make quite a story, a planet inhabited only by women. And many, many, many things happened, which I do now for recall, between the Gaian women and the Orion hunters. The memories of those long epochs of time when that Thonian romance developed have actually been uploaded by Sophia herself to the Pleuromic Center. And those memories may well become accessible to us in the immediate future. I'd like to pick up that topic in the next briefing, if I can remember what I'm talking about. But to cut to the chase here, that is to say, to cut to the hunt, the most ancient legend of Orion says simply this: Artemis, the huntress, was one of the Gaian she, one of the Gaian fairies. She was not only a great hunter herself, who used the bow and arrow more skillfully than a man, but she was the guardian of the hunt, and the overseer. And Artemis made it clear to the Orion hunters that they could take down as much game as they liked and gather the totemic indicators from these games, from the game, that is to say, hooves, horns, feathers, various implements and decorative gear, because the Orion men enjoyed, as hunters today do enjoy, decorating themselves with these totemic items. So Artemis said, fine, there's an abundance of animals in our habitat, but I do set you to a quota. You can kill many and you can enjoy the hunt, but you cannot exceed your quota. And as the ancient story goes, and this is a true memory of events that unfolded on this planet, some hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years ago, the Orion hunters did exceed their quota. And this, the legend says, the Greek myth tells us, this act of excess, of violent excess, an inability to set limits and regulate themselves, brought the wrath of Gaia herself upon the Orion hunters. And the Greek myth, recorded by several authors, says that Gaia herself, or Artemis, the guardian of the hunt, acting on Gaia's inspiration, caused the scorpion to appear and bite Orion and kill Orion. And so the naive way in which this tale is represented, the folkloric version of this tale, was represented in sky lore in order to teach people how to observe the heavens. And so the navigators and the sky watchers of the ancient Greek times who received this lore from people before them, this is not Greek lore in the sense that it originated with the Greeks. It is just Greek language sky lore in the sense that it was preserved by the Greeks. The Greeks thought, look, there's the sky, and when Orion sets, the scorpion rises. So watch Orion go down in the west, and then turn to your left and look. The scorpion rises in the east. Orion and the scorpion are opposite. Orion, the scorpion, and the bull are opposite, aren't they? Antares in the bull is almost exactly opposite. Excuse me, Antares in the scorpion is almost exactly opposite Aldebaran in the bull. That is called the Antares Aldebaran axis, and it corresponds to December 3-4 or June 3-4 in the calendric sequence. The fact that when Orion sets in the west, the scorpion rises in the east reminds us that Orion died from the bite of the ascending scorpion. So to return now to my fantastic breakthrough with the scorpion scales scenario, I've understood now that the scorpion power does not upset the scales, it resets the scales. And this reset is now underway. Certain things need to occur, certain things need to fall apart and fall away in our human, social, and collective reality for this reset to be effective, for it to actually make a difference. The reset is a cosmic event, indeed, an event of supernatural powers and supernatural dynamics involving the witnessing of the aeons themselves and the Nahual of the aeon Sophia who achieves it. And we are the witnesses to her Nahual, just as the aeons are from their perspective. And what she achieves in resetting the scales can be seen in the complete breakdown of the financial system and the final and complete exposure of the fraudulence of the rigged system. The financial system is rigged, and so it has to be reset on fair terms. And this is indeed happening in this time span since the perigee hits moved into the constellation of the scales. And those developments are due to be completed March 31st with the last hit in the scales. So this is mighty, mighty exciting. This is mighty exciting. And as the hits become concentrated now in the torso of the scorpion, starting with the first one in the very middle of the torso on the 12th of December, at the end of this Kamala shift, just look how those two things are juxtaposed. It's absolutely remarkable. As this occurs, we are living into the reality of this reset. Sophia commands the reset, but we as her witnesses participate. And to the extent that you can be instructed by Kamala simultaneously, or Kamala simultaneously in the mysteries of love and death, you can be led to understand how the death-dealing power can only be wielded by someone who truly embodies the awareness of transcendent love. But that does not mean that the application of that lethal power on a predator is an act of love toward that predator. It is certainly not the case. So on we go into this great adventure. There's so much more that I could say here. I have been able to report to you because I am really saturated with the pregnant truth of this moment we are living, absolutely saturated. I would like to convey to you, if I can, in the final moments of this briefing, the way that I am sensing the current stall in the eye of the bull. You may recall that the stalls that occurred between the before the satanic head of Cetus were trying, to say the least. It was like trying to hold your gaze on a gruesome accident or on some gruesome scene like the disembowelment of a child in front of your eyes. The tendency would want to be to turn away. I don't want to talk about it anymore. I don't want to look at these masks of evil. Every time I rip one off, there's another one behind it that's even more gruesome. And so it was a difficult and daunting and indeed gruesome activity to hold the first attention, or excuse me, the second attention, because the apogee involves the second attention, to hold the second attention steady in those preceding stall moments. Now that the lunar apogee is stalling in the eye of the bull, I feel something entirely different. First of all, although I am still looking into the origins of violence of our species, I'm still looking into the question of the blood lust and why we are the superlative killers on this planet. Although I'm still looking into this as a mystery, the beauty of what I'm perceiving is overwhelmingly evident. It becomes overwhelmingly evident to me now at every moment of the day that the solution for humanity within Gaia's correction is something of an immense and all-encompassing beauty. The truth of this moment of her correction and our immersion in it is the most vastly beautiful thing, the most vastly beautiful truth to which the human animal can attain. And that beauty is streaming through the eye of the bull. And in that engendering gaze, a truth about ourselves as a species is being brought to definition. And the clarity and depth of that definition, I guarantee you, are staggering. They will stop you in your tracks. You will be like Socrates, frozen on the spot by the revelation of the daimonic brilliance of this truth, the daimonic lucidity of this truth, which is nothing less than the truth about who we really are and what is our purpose and what is the purpose. In Sophia's terms, of our action in her experiment. I have seen that purpose for the first time, subliminally, in the course of the last 10 days. I can't tell you what it is now because I can't recall it. You will know by now that very often the subliminal instruction of the Dakinis and that of Vivi herself cannot be recalled. You have to return to it again and again in real time until you integrate it bodily, and then your body remembers it. The Dakini is the memory of the body. That is a quotation from a Tibetan tantric text. I believe it would be the Hevajra Tantra. The Dakini is the memory of the body. So when your body remembers the sublime truth shown to you by Sophia, then you know that truth and you carry that truth and express it and share it with others. It's easy to say that the Gaia navigation experiment leads to the realization of the purpose of the divine experiment on this planet. It's easy enough to say that, and I've said it quite a few times. I have to tell you, I myself am just beginning to realize what I'm talking about and what a momentous proposition that is. I have seen this purpose. I have. And when I see it again, the second or the third time, my body can retain it, I know. I'm trained for that. And yours can as well. You're in this training. It comes fast. Her way is fast and vast. Gaia's way is vast and fast. And this is how it is in the engendering gaze of the bull. The quality of this stall is a steadying power. It's an effect of steadiness. The gaze of the bull confers a steadiness that is now being translated into your own mind, into your body-mind. With that translation, you can stand on your feet on this planet with a steadiness and strength and confidence that comes from the Nahual of the Wisdom Goddess herself. Steady as she goes. Steady as she goes, and may she keep you in the engendering gaze.